butterfly, as soft and gentle as a sigh. The multicolored moods of love like its satin wings.
Health, beauty, and well-being, and sometimes sex. Listen to Radio Gorgeous every day now. We've all lived long enough to have had a trauma. Divorce, death, domestic abuse, alcoholism, health problems. It may be due to our partner, sibling or child. Whatever happens, it leaves a physical and mental effect on our minds and bodies. Today we're meeting Susan Cow-Miller, who's a specialist in healing. She has written a book about her life, and it is Survive and Thrive After Trauma. Susan, hello and welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here.
So you are a matrix re-imprinting practitioner, which is a big mouthful, but we'll speak about that later. Because what I'd like to do is find out how you got there. In other words, what brought you to becoming a healer? I suspect it was because of a trauma in your own life, because I've read your book. I know you have had a trauma. And it was to do with your relationship with your husband, which started off really happily. You met him at university and you had loads in common and you had a lovely marriage and you had two children.
That's correct. Yes, I met my husband in 1973.
You moved to a place that had a nice village pub, mm-hmm. and he started going, well, you all went there as a family, but then he started going there more on his own and drinking more.
Well, our relationship, we always enjoyed a drink. When we were students together, we did what students do. Most of the time we were together, we certainly a Friday night, we would go to the pub, etc. Our life did not revolve around alcohol, but we always enjoyed, you know, a good weekend, a good night out. But throughout our time together, you know, my husband would drink regularly, and it just got worse. He couldn't sit with a glass of water, for example. You know, it was all these things. Occasionally, when things were the last 10 years of our marriage, I was aware of things that were concerning me, but every now and then I would bring them up every 2 or 3 months, and a great row would happen and say, well, I've done it I'll wait another 3 months and bring it up again. And eventually it did cause big problems, and 2 years.
You persuaded him, though, to dry out, which I think is incredible. I mean, not many people can persuade. That means he probably wanted to.
Sure.
Because I don't think you can do that without wanting to.
He decided he was going to dry out, finally, but because I had forced him to, he went through the process of drying out. Now, that was very interesting, because he chose to do it when my son was doing his GCSEs. And although I was very supportive, I didn't actually know how to behave. I didn't know how to be normal. You know,
you didn't know whether you could have a drink. Well, you allowed one.
Well, the secret, the point, the truth of that is that on occasions I would, not during the day, but in the evening, some evenings I would have it in a mug.
Yeah.
When I was cooking the dinner.
Yeah, good idea.
You know, because I didn't want to chuck it in his face, basically, that I was doing it. But equally, because he had this crap situation going on, I did not feel I had to join him.
No.
Because I had been building up and building up. What was I going to do? Was I going to look at the divorce route? And that seemed totally alien to me.
Yeah.
But he did do the treatment, and he was dry for, let's say, 2 months. Just weeks before he decided to dry out, I made a decision to go to Paris with a girlfriend of mine, because life was not pleasant and I knew I wanted to have some fun. And unfortunately, this was 2 months into his drying out, he chose that time to take my 15-year-old son to the pub. And I found out within sort of 2 days of being in Paris for a short weekend that things just weren't what I expected, you know, in the text messages.
Did he get your son drunk?
No. Mm. And in talking to my son afterwards, my son said, he said, I thought Dad was just trying to do a bit of bonding. He didn't realise quite how catastrophic it was.
Susan then told me that over the course of a year, she decided to divorce Gordon, and finally, on the night that he was to move out, Susan had been to the pub, he'd sent a lot of abusive texts, and this is what happened.
So anyway, I came home, and, you know, I can see every single detail of this, and he was lying listening to U2, so U2.
That's his way of relaxing.
Yes, yes.
There's a lot of mention of U2 in the book.
Yes. My daughter had gone up to bed, my son had gone up to bed. You know, my son sadly had said grim things to him, probably even the only time my son said grim things to him. My daughter had said whatever she would say, but she was a 15-year-old. Anyway, I remember distinctly, I thought, right, I've got to take this wedding ring off. And we're still actually sleeping in the same bed at this point, because occasionally I would have a mattress downstairs, and I thought, why is it always me doing this? So we were still sleeping in the same bed. My sister could not get over this. She said, for God's sake. I said, well,
it's the comfiest bed in the house.
You know?
And you're right on each other side. I mean, yeah. You know, there's a lot of gap in between.
Well, but anyway, you're presumably looking for the whole bit here. Okay. So,
come on, Susan.
Okay.
You're bearing the soul.
So anyway, I went to bed and I remember thinking, gosh, she's leaving in a couple of days. And I wasn't one to sleep around. And I thought, well, my thoughts were, God, I won't get a shag in a while. that was exactly, I mean, there's no point. That, and that was the way I was looking at it. I didn't think, anyway, came to bed and I said, I think that was my exact words. And I said, and he said, well, I might surprise you, I might, you know, why not? So anyway, to cut a long story short, and there wasn't, it was okay, it was fine, it was what it was.
Was it lovemaking or was it sex?
It was sad. Sad sex. Mm-hmm. I don't know, it was...
Yeah.
Lovemaking? I don't know. It wasn't a quick bang. Sorry, my now husband said, speak nicely, Susan.
You can't help who you are.
it was the last time we thought we'd sleep together, and
yeah.
Neither of us were ashamed, or we were confused, and we did. I suppose actually I was going to say now we did make love, but it wasn't the most beautiful. Anyway, enough of that. Straight away though, afterwards,
I went downstairs to
probably make a cup of tea, something exciting like that. And I heard a thud. I was also eating hummus at the time. And I thought,
what's the upside?
Yeah. So within about a minute, I suppose, I went upstairs. And actually, I'd gone downstairs to get my drink of water because he said he wasn't feeling well. And when I went upstairs, he was lying in the bed unconscious. And... I was squealing for the children. It was about 2 a.m. to come and help, and because I didn't know what to do. He was a dead weight, literally, and I was trying to do CPR, if that's the word, the pressing in his chest. And the bed was so soft that I wasn't getting anywhere. Screaming, that my daughter came through, and then my son eventually came through, and he thought we'd been having another row, so why bother get out his bed?
Yeah.
You know, terrible stuff. And so I got my daughter to phone 999. I started doing mouth to mouth, and although my teacher, when you're emotionally involved in this, you know, it just goes out the window. I wasn't holding his nose, or I wasn't doing it right. And anyway, Rachel was getting instructions from the ambulance people.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Makes your heart feel strange inside. It flutters like soft wings in flight. Love is like a butterfly, a rare and gentle
thing. And they arrived. And for some reason, they administered adrenaline straight away because he never regained consciousness. And my daughter and I must have suggested making them a cup of tea. God knows, but we couldn't get back into the bedroom with the way they'd manoeuvred the body. But my son, My son had to hold his father's head while and count. They had to count something. I've forgotten what it was. Count the seconds to do with the injections. There were so many needles. They'd really tried their best to bring them back. And my son, who hasn't read my book, just said he just could see his father's face going bluer and bluer. And so then we got in and they said, we're going to take him to the hospital, which was only 2 miles up the road. And they managed to manoeuvre him downstairs. And this is in the middle of March. And we were all obviously in a totally stunned place.
Yeah.
So they took Gordon outside on the trolley and they didn't cover him up when he was naked, and they went up to collect all the needles, presumably in case accidents happened. I remember thinking, why aren't they covering him up? Anyway, they went away to the hospital and we set off in the car behind them, and I remember my son saying, do you know, I think they'll be able to sort him at the hospital. We had no idea that he was dead. Oh. So that...
When did they tell you?
They told us as soon as we arrived, and we were in a little waiting room. I obviously suspected. The children were very quiet. And this young boy of about 12, who was a doctor,
yeah.
I feel sure it was his first time. And he did a good job of it. But he basically said that, you know, he died. They couldn't bring him back.
A heart attack?
A heart attack.
And how old was he?
49.
What?
49, yeah.
Good God.
And...
Poor children, sorry. I mean.
Geez. Oh, that... Well, there's so much you could say about that, and we can discuss that later. Dreadful. So,
but shock, though, that you three had to drive back without a man that had been in your bed earlier that night.
It was very strange. A friend came to join us, the friend I'd been out with, and we just sat and made tea and eventually went to bed. I had a horrible phone call to make within about 2 hours.
I suppose you had to call all his nearest and dearest.
I told his sister.
Yeah.
I told my sister. And I told a very good friend of mine. And his sister... I mean, I was very matter-of-fact. I was an automatic pilot at this point.
I think you become very practical, don't
very
you?
Very practical. Yeah. I mean, from the grief point of view, I've never howled. In 10 years, I've never howled over this. Which probably isn't that good, but, you know...
Yeah.
But I had to phone his mother. His sister asked how we wanted to play this. This is about 3 a.m.
Oh.
And I knew I had to get at least 1 hour of sleep and then phone his mother. And they knew we were divorcing, but they didn't know why. They didn't really know why. They wondered why I would be divorcing him.
Mm.
They had no idea. Because he wanted to keep it all quiet, just within the four walls.
What about his alcoholism?
His alcoholism. I was having none of that.
No.
Because I'd known these people for 30 years.
Yes, exactly.
I owed them more.
So had they had no idea about it when you rang them?
They had no idea that alcohol was really the problem, if my memory serves me right.
Wow.
But I worded it that he died of a heart attack, which was true.
Mm.
And then, of course, maybe they didn't know that he had drinking problems. Or that maybe I said I was divorcing him because of drinking. He was terribly angry. I must have told them, because I must have told them in the December, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But it was dreadful, you know, telling his mother.
Yeah. Absolutely dreadful. So, so how traumatic? Because your book is about survive and thrive over trauma.
Yeah.
How traumatized were you, and how long did it take you to? You know, how did you get over it?
I firmly believe that the build-up to the divorce was the first death, and that was me dealing with. That was, how can you possibly say that was the main trauma? I realised that was a huge upset for me.
Because that was revaluating your whole life.
Yeah. When he died, it was stunningly shocking. Not a surprise. It wasn't a surprise that his health... Potentially, it was always, you know, something like that's in the cards when people drink like that. You know, I wasn't aware that the fact that he smoked was the real problem underneath it all, because he smoked and his arteries were seriously blocked.
How many did he smoke a day?
20. Yeah. Well, I mean, you can shrug your shoulders. Yeah. I smoked 20 as well. But... stress, alcohol, lack of exercise. A lovely person. His the funeral cremation was well attended, and I spoke at it.
Wow.
I spoke at it because it was, certain things were clear as crystal. I worry about stupid, pathetic things. And I knew that I deserved to say something. One, I wasn't going to badmouth. I wasn't stupid enough or angry enough to badmouth him at his funeral. I wanted to say that although, because people knew we were divorcing, a lot of people knew we were divorcing, I wanted to say that I valued all my time I'd spent with him, or most of the 26 years.
Yeah.
Because people liked him enormously.
Yeah.
He was a good person.
What was the reason you liked him? So they, I mean, we're going off the subject a little bit.
Yeah.
But alcoholism is usually to do with some pain they have. So what was he not facing up to?
Well, I wish I knew. I think when he went self-employed, he had, his therapist said eventually when she spoke to me, she thought I was probably going to be angry with her, but I wasn't in the slightest. She said, you know, when they were having their chats, he said he thought maybe he jumped too far too quickly because his father was a head gardener on an estate, very well thought of, very high in his skills. But he, Gordon, was the first one, the whole family ever, to go to university and be a professional and deal with the professional stress. And then he went self-employed when the children were 12 and 10. So he wanted me to work with him and be very supportive. I'm afraid I tried to do that and realised that the marriage wasn't going to... I was going to lose myself.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I opted out of that. I hope that he would have taken on an assistant, you know, a VA, let's say. Nowadays they talk about VAs, but no. So he was very stressed.
Now, let's talk about matrix re-imprinting, because how soon did you find this after?
The first couple of years, I knew intuitively that I had been under a considerable stress. I had no idea how to deal with it. I kept seeing the word Reiki every now and then. So I did become I am a Reiki practitioner. Met someone who then said...
Is that a kind of spiritual massage?
It's healing energy that comes through the practitioner, Reiki, and is transferred. It's a hands-on therapy, universal power and universal energy, healing energy, which finds its place.
So do you have to have a kind of like calling for it, or could you just do it? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I would say from the Reiki, my Reiki knowledge, that there is a calling, there's a need, and many healing practitioners start with Reiki, and then we all develop and go our own routes. But
so would you call yourself a healer?
I would call myself a healer. I would call myself an emotional healer. It can also be called energy healing, because we're dealing with the energy that can get trapped inside our body, which is potentially very dangerous, for our physical health.
And mental health. Together,
yes.
Yeah.
So I discovered EFT, which is Emotional Freedom Technique.
Which is the tapping.
Tapping.
Yeah.
Tapping on energy channels, acupuncture channels. It's also known as psychological acupuncture. And I work with people, if someone came in and I'd say, where are we going to start? How are you feeling? So we're working with people's feelings. We're lowering stress and anxiety, lowering it, managing it, clearing it by finding out what makes us sad, what makes us angry, what's causing us distress, who's causing us distress. When might we have felt that before? But the re-imprinting is when we know exactly the story. We can see ourselves being told something that's made us who we are, a limiting belief. It can be a horrendous trauma. It can be patterns of behaviour that started for a particular reason. So re-imprinting works after stress levels are lowered. It works because the subconscious it does not know what's right or wrong, true or false. So we re-imprint a better ending. The situation, the memory is always there. The statements, the anger, the whatever situation always happened, the energy's taken away from it and we have a stronger positive energy.
What about if people want to buy your book? What about if people want to contact you? You're based in Hampshire. How far would you, you know, how far would you travel to people, or do people travel to you? How does that
work? I tend not to travel to people. I'm prepared to consider travelling to people. And I'm certainly prepared to travel for talks, etc. And I live in Rowlands Castle, which is south of Petersfield in the A3. My clients have travelled, you know, an hour away to come to me. Equally, I would consider travelling, but I have worked frequently over the telephone with clients because it's the listening. The listening.
How would you do the tapping then?
The tapping, we make sure that we've had plenty practice. I'll have sent them the information. They'll have seen my videos. I've got a YouTube channel. YouTube.
Great. What's that called?
It's YouTube/ Susan Cowe, Cowe.
Yeah.
I've got various tapping routines where you can see me, watch me tapping for fear or anger or helplessness or maintaining confidence, and they're only 10 minutes in length, and you can adapt to your own words. They're not totally prescriptive. You can make up your own words. So if it was a fear or anger, you know, you say where you're feeling your fear or anger. So that's my YouTube. My website is called Hampshire EFT, and it's www.hampshire-eft.co.uk. I do have a website which is the title of my book, Survive and Thrive After Trauma. Survive and Thrive After Trauma talks about my story, my life. The second part is many treatments and therapies that people can use to move on, to help them, a whole variety. And the third part of the book's interviews by others now thriving who share their little golden nugget that helped them, and they're all different. I've also got a programme aimed at divorce people who are slow at moving on or ready to move on but want help or guidance, and it's called Recharge Your Power. Very specifically at divorce. So I think that's... I also work Skype. Skype's very successful because you can see or hear.
So you are global, Susan. You've just got to face it, darling.
Thank you. Yes, I'm global. I can work anywhere.
So lovely to have you today on Radio Gorgeous, talking about Matrix Reimprinting. And you can buy Susan's book from Amazon, if you like, or her website. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you.
That rare and gentle feeling. This podcast was presented by Josephine Pembroke and produced by Josephine Pembroke and edited by Caitlin Hobbs. Whenever I